How do you have a recession when the government is like 30% of GDP? It's almost mathematically impossible, which it is right now.
Welcome to Bankless, where today we explore how notable crypto trader Arthur Hayes is positioning his crypto portfolio at the end of this 2024 going into 2025. This is Ryan Sean Adams. I'm here with David Hoffman, and we're here to help you become more bankless. All right, first we got to get this out of the way. We've recorded this on election day. So literally the day America is showing up to vote at the polls. We don't know who won the election at the time of recording. Neither does Arthur. He's like literally getting ready to go to bed. He's in a different time zone.
But the good thing is Arthur doesn't care.
Yeah, it's kind of fitting.
It's not actually relevant. He says the election's irrelevant.
Exactly.
So it actually kind of fits.
It doesn't matter according to him. We talk about that in the first part of it. But to him, the outcome is really the same no matter what. In addition to the election, we also talk about the Chinese property bubble and the coming money cannon, which Arthur thinks will be bigger than the COVID stimulus. We also talk about the Fed's next move and why Treasury is sucking all the oxygen out of the room. He has some choice words and labels for Jerome Powell.
Arthur has a lot of choice words, so some viewer discretion might be advised. Don't listen to this one with kids in the car.
There you go. Yeah, thanks, David. We should shout that out. He also tells us his positioning for the prospect of recession and war, and then we get into his crypto portfolio, what he's holding and why. One of my favorite parts of the episode is about why he's bullish ETH, but not for the same reasons that David and I are bullish ETH. So we get into some debate on the topic of whether ETH is money, whether it can be money. And I want to thank David, we got a little bit of concession from him, but like not much.
We identified the gap between us and Arthur, which I think is a very overcomable gap. We just need time. Having Arthur on the show is always useful just to kind of get a download on a pretty zoomed out perspective for somebody who zooms out very, very far into the ultra macro, but then also like plays in like degen meme coin trenches. He's a guy that can trade it all. So let's go ahead and get right into that conversation with Arthur Hayes. But first, a message to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible, especially Kraken, our preferred exchange for buying crypto assets in 2024. If you do not have an account with Kraken, consider clicking the link in the show notes and getting started with Kraken today. If you want a crypto trading experience backed by world-class security and award-winning support teams, then head over to Kraken, one of the longest-standing and most secure crypto platforms in the world. Kraken is on a journey to build a more accessible, inclusive, and fair financial system, making it simple and secure for everyone, everywhere, to trade crypto. Kraken's intuitive trading tools are designed to grow with you, empowering you to make your first or your 100th trade in just a few clicks. And there's an award-winning client support team available 24/7 to help you along the way, along with a whole range of educational guides, articles, and videos. With products and features like Kraken Pro and Kraken NFT Marketplace and a seamless app to bring it all together, it's really the perfect place to get your complete crypto experience. So check out the simple, secure, and powerful way for everyone to trade crypto, whether you're a complete beginner or a seasoned pro. Go to kraken.com/bankless to see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Radically simple ideas always tend to catch on. That's why Cartesi did the hard work of putting Linux on chain, so that building dApps can be radically simple by using Python or JavaScript and their suite of libraries. Simple, like not rebuilding the basics from scratch. Simple, like dedicated scalable compute for your dApp. Simple, like building dApps however you want. Web3 should be simple too, like bread and butter. Cartesi brings radically simple solutions to Ethereum, so developers can do what they do best. Build. Go ahead and discover a flexible modular stack on Cartesi and build your most powerful, ambitious project yet. Visit cartesi.io/simple and simplify your blockchain journey and start building today. New projects are coming online to the Mantle Layer 2 every single week. Why is this happening? Maybe it's because Mantle has been on the frontier of Layer 2 design architecture since it first started building Mantle DA, powered by technology from EigenDA. Maybe it's because users are coming onto the Mantle Layer 2 to capture some of the highest yields available in DeFi and to automatically receive the points and tokens being accrued by the $3 billion Mantle treasury in the Mantle Reward Station. Maybe it's because the Mantle team is one of the most helpful teams to build with, giving you grants, liquidity support, and venture partners to help bootstrap your Mantle application. Maybe it's all of these reasons all put together. So if you're a dev and you want to build on one of the best foundations in crypto, or you're a user looking to claim some ownership on Mantle's DeFi apps, click the link in the show notes to getting started with Mantle.
Bankless Nation, very excited to introduce you once again to Arthur Hayes. He is a trader. He is a macro commentator. He is the co-founder of BitMEX, also the CIO of the Maelstrom Fund. We want to talk about how he's positioned. This is the end of 2024. We're going into 2025. A lot of things happening in the world. Arthur, welcome back to Bankless.
Hi there. How you doing, guys?
Good, man. Okay, so it's an election day over here in the U.S. where David and I are located, so everyone's going crazy. You know, a lot of, I was dropping my kids off to school.
Oh,
big,
wow.
You know, Trump flags, you know, somebody on the side of the road waving flags. Like, it's a little crazy over here. What's your plan? I don't think you're located in the U.S. right now, but like, what are you doing today? What are you watching? What are you paying attention to?
I mean, I'm doing nothing. I'm about to, after I get off done with this, I'll be going to bed and I'll wake up tomorrow morning and I'll play tennis. And at some point, you know, I'll check my Bloomberg and see if either Harris or Trump conceded. And if not, then you strap yourself in for weeks or months of a contentious battle of, you know, who won, right? I mean, similar to what happened in 2000 with Bush and Gore.
Yeah.
When they were debating what hanging chads and all sorts of other bullshit, because even, you know, paper ballots and I don't know, it's just nonsense, right?
Like,
and
do you think any of this really matters? Let's talk about for investors or for crypto. Do you think it matters who wins?
No, I don't think it matters at all. I think the regulatory apparatus will be what it is. I don't think it's kind of irrelevant. The reason why Bitcoin is $1.2, $1.3 trillion asset class is not because of regulations, either pro or against. You know, the reason why the Ethereum decentralized computer is the second largest cryptocurrency has nothing to do with regulations. The reason why there's all these other meme coins and all these things happening has nothing to do about, you know, this or that politician and what their stance on crypto is. It's a fundamental, a better technology of moving, communicating what value is amongst humanity, and then money printing, right? And so, you know, we I don't really talk that much about the technology because it's not really that relevant for most people. It's all about, okay, well, I can see that my paycheck buys me less every day, every year. I can see that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. I can see that, you know, nothing has changed, but, oh, look at this new thing called crypto and look at all these individuals who've achieved generational wealth in a very short period of time because there's this thing, there's a new technology, there's a new way of networking and communicating, which has allowed a certain portion of humanity to escape the inflation and debasement and, you know, financial repression and all that sort of stuff. And so I don't see any of that changing in the United States and China and Japan, European Union, any countries, right? Everyone's doing the same stuff. Everybody has a fractional fiat banking system. Everyone has expended a lot of credit to build stuff. And a lot of that stuff at this point isn't worth the money that was put in, but no one's willing to recognize the loss and impoverish some rich people. So they're just going to inflate it away and hope that poor people don't revolt. And so that's where we are. And so I had, you know, Donald Trump, Kamala Harris, two sides of the same coin. It doesn't really matter who wins. It's fun theater. I'm sure all the networks in America love all the campaign finance dollars that are going to buy ads and whatnot. And, you know, Zuckerberg and Sergey Brin and all, you know, all the social media bros, they love the billions of dollars that are getting spent by each campaign to try to sway opinion. And maybe there's outside countries trying to influence opinion as well. So everybody's just spending money on media. It doesn't matter.
So does that mean that you're not positioned in any particular way as it relates to the election?
I mean, I was long before. I didn't reduce my exposure.
Yeah, you have not changed your positions.
Maybe I have some cash on the sidelines that I'm not deploying yet because I think it's going to be a bit, you know, there's some questions about how the Fed and Treasury react depending on who wins and how that sort of plays out. But, you know, let's say by the end of January, all that'll be solved, I think. And it'll be very clear, you know, the path that they're going to go on and then, you know, get on the horse.
That's so funny because I think a lot of people in crypto agree with you in large strokes, but like they do still tend to think that politicians have the ability to at least slow things down. So they might say, yeah, broad strokes, Arthur, you're right. You know, nothing stops this train. The money printer goes burn, crypto is going to like ascend and it's just like a better communication network. And that's true. And like, if you measure that in decades, but like there's Gary Gensler's of the world, for instance, who could just like throw a monkey wrench in like, you know, Western finance clarity around like crypto and just like slow it down, put the brakes on. Do you think that that's the case, at least in the short run? Like some of these politicians and the administration choices might have some impact. Like, I mean, Trump has come out and said he's very pro crypto. I mean, you would think that would be bullish if he won the election on the crypto side then, and like more bullish maybe than Kamala Harris. Do you see that there's like at least a short term play here?
Cool. I think even if, let's say that the regulators actually mattered, which I don't think they do in a macro sense to the long-term direction of crypto. the specific ways in which America is governed means that even though President Trump or Harris can say pro-crypto things or anti-crypto things, they don't write bills. So bills are written by congresspeople and senators. And, you know, in the wake of what is it, the Chevron case, where the Supreme Court basically said Congress makes laws, not the unelected bureaucrats, it's the onus is even more so on the rulemaking body to create a rule, whatever it is, good or bad, and to put that bill on the president's desk for him or her to sign it, right? And so if we're talking about the most polarized electorate in modern history, probably the next last 100 years, how the fuck are these guys going to create a bill that's going to get on their desk, regardless of what either candidate says for or against? So there's absolutely no chance that there's going to be any sort of bipartisan thing that they can agree on of what crypto regulation should be. And so even if you believe Trump, and even if you believe that if there's one person in charge of whatever regulatory agency, they can somehow wave the magic wand and all of a sudden all these institutional investors are going to go and they're going to market YOLO Bitcoin. And you're going to, you know, it's all going to be, all, oh, it's going to be from like $70,000 to $1 million. That's just not how it works. And so on a micro legislative level. And so I think people just don't understand. Yeah, well, the Americans didn't, you know, pay attention to civics class, and then everyone else was not American. Understandable why you wouldn't understand this.
Is there anything about the election that you're paying attention to? Because there's more than just the president, right? We have the presidential election, we have the Senate, we have the House. Is there anything about the election that is signaled to you?
I just want to see the outcome, right? Yeah. What's the makeup? And then that determines, like, who gets the money? So which particular part of the American economy or electorate gets the free money? How quickly that happens, right? And so if it's one party controls all three branches of government, then money gets printed faster. But if it's a divided situation, then you need a financial crisis or some sort of war that says, oh, okay, now we're all together in the printing of the money. And so we'll put aside our differences and we'll do the same thing we would have done if we were in charge. And so it's just the pace of what happens.
So it's really, it all comes back to the money printer. Yeah. That's the biggest signal to you.
That's it.
That's it.
Do the math. If you look at the, I've done the math. I looked at the recent presentation to the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee by the Treasury that was released late last week. And they have a nice chart and it shows the largest five expenditures of the federal government, which are healthcare and Social Security, defense and veterans benefits, and interest on the debt. And so all five of those combined grow faster than nominal GDP. So your spending is growing faster than your ability to tax to fund it. There's just mathematically no other way but printing money. And so I don't care who gets put in office. Both Trump and Harris are going to bomb somebody. They might not bomb the one that the other one's going to bomb, but they're bombing somebody. So defense is going up. And nobody cuts benefits for old people because they vote. And so if you want to be the congressperson that cut the benefits of the boomers and the silent generation, then you won't be in office in 2 years. And so it's a very simple calculation that spending can only go in one direction because it's in the politician's interest to continue to spend.
Okay, we're going to come back to that. I want to come back to that in the context of what China's doing too. You've written articles about this and we'll pivot back to the Fed too. But it's like the high level for Arthur Hayes, it seems like, is just like they're going to print money. It's just how fast, right? And who's going to print it doesn't matter. It's just how fast. Okay, but like before we get there, let's talk about the cycle that we're in. Because a lot of people in crypto are a little bit confused. Like even David and I have been talking like, wait, is this a bull run? I mean, it kind of feels like it because Bitcoin's close to all-time highs. And yet institutional demand driven, it doesn't feel like there's a new crop of crypto investors. So are we really in a bull run? Are we like, so what's your sense of the crypto market cycle right now? Is this bear, bull? Is this something else? Do you even think about it like that?
We had a very good bull run from, call it, late 2022 up until early 2024, so in the April time period. And if you, you know, want to be a very good student of money markets, you can take a look at the reverse repo facility at the Fed. And September 2022 was when it hit the high of $2.5 trillion, and it was drained down to, what I don't know, was now like $200 billion over the next 18, 24 months. And that corresponds perfectly to the rise in crypto. So there was a bull market. Janet Yellen said, fuck you, Jay Powell, we're fucking printing money. And she did it, pumped in $2.5 trillion into the economy. Every asset went nuts, right? We're at S&P's at all-time high, NASDAQ's at all-time highs, crypto's at all-time highs, and certain asset classes. So there has been a bull market. It hasn't been as broad-based as traditional ones, where every single piece of shit altcoin is 10x, right? And I was like, what the fuck? I thought I just had to, like, you know, buy Bitcoin. Then the next week I sell my Bitcoin. Then I buy the worst shitcoin that I could find on crypto Twitter. That goes up 10x and I sell that for a bit. Then I go back into Bitcoin and then I rinse and repeat. But it didn't happen like that this time. But in a macro sense, there has been a bull market. It's just that very few people have participated in it. And so you have a lot of people who said, oh, it worked like this in the past cycles, therefore it must work like this in this cycle. And they got hosed.
Sorry, David, you looked like you had something to say
No, I was contemplating.
Okay.
All the dog shit in your portfolio?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
Yeah, David, it's like he's thinking about his life choices. My God, man. All right, so what's your base case here, Arthur, then, like, four-year cycle? Either the way others played out?
Someone else asked me this, like, oh, it's going to be the four-year cycle. Like, why try to be prescriptive? Just adapt to what is. I think if you try to put these prescriptive, oh, it's a four-year cycle, therefore in the second or third year, whatever it is, I must do this. Well, okay, if everyone does that, then you don't get the result of the past. So I don't know what how many years this cycle is going to be.
It doesn't even matter.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Look at the liquidity cycle. Bitcoin, I think, for the first time, is very clearly directly related to liquidity. And China was in the past. It was the dollar this time. And it goes back to China and then maybe the global aggregate. But the tech is solid. The tech changes less and less, obviously, as Bitcoin gets older and older. And the thing that really matters is how much fiat is being debased. How fast? From where? What's the pipe? Understand that. And I think you get a much better sense of where Bitcoin and crypto goes. Is it a four-year cycle? I don't know. Could be four. Could be five. Could be six. Could be 10. I don't know. It doesn't matter.
All right. Let's come back to your crypto portfolio a little bit later and see how kind of you're positioning for this. Cause like, I think a lot of people are still wondering if we're going to have this play out, like we're going to get the altcoin kind of like trade going on, but we'll get to that later. Let's talk about liquidity. Cause you think that's key to understanding all this. All right. So a lot of crypto investors don't understand China. I mean, I think a lot of us like barely understand like kind of like macro and the Fed. You seem to have a take on China, which is basically, this is a quote from your recent article on the 28th. Given that the Chinese property bubble was the largest in human history, that's what you said, the largest in human history, the amount of yuan credit created will rival the sum of dollars printed in the US in response to COVID 2020, 2021. Wow. So you're talking about a Chinese property bubble and you're talking about like a big money cannon injection of fiat liquidity into these markets as a result. Give us the context here. So like, how did we get here? What is what you call like monetary chemotherapy and why is China heading in that direction? But like, why is there a property bubble in the first place?
Well, at the end of the day, the Chinese government said, we want to industrialize very quickly. And they said, okay, well, industrialization happens in cities. They were a very agrarian economy coming into, you know, 1950 after the disastrous civil war between Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong. And so the Communist Party said, we're going to urbanize. And so every five-year plan, there's an urbanization target. Now Mao fucked things up pretty bad while he was in power until 1976. And then things started to liberalize under Deng Xiaoping, who was basically like, I'll do whatever it takes just to create prosperity in China. And if that goes against sort of Maoism or traditional Marxist-Lenin theory, whatever. Let's just grow. And so let's get these people into the cities. And so, again, all credit is determined by state preferences because the largest banks are owned by the state. The largest companies in any sector are all state-owned. And so if the government says we want to have people in cities, then what do? We build stuff. And so if you're going to move, I don't know however many hundreds of people have moved from farms into the city in about 30 years, right? That's just going to create a epic boom in land prices, which I think the figure that I have is they're up like 80x over the past 20 years. It's going to create an epic boom in all the other manufacturing and industrial goods you have to use to build apartments, cement, air conditioners, you know, cheap furniture, right? All this stuff. All these companies did very, very well from the late 80s until, you know, 2020. And so the problem was that at a certain point, you reach saturation in how much property you need for a particular amount of people. And they reached that saturation. And then they said, well, government policy says we need to build housing. The only thing that banks are going to lend for is not the only thing, but one of the main things is property. Therefore, I shall buy property. I shall build property. And if I'm a Chinese, you know, investor, I can't invest abroad. The currency is restricted. Of course, the super wealthy are able to get their money out, but the average Chinese saver doesn't have access to foreign investments. And so when you're getting 2-3% in your bank account and the economy is growing at 10% a year, you're like, well, fuck, that's not going to cut it. I need something else. Property was the only thing that they really could invest in that had a track record of always going up, was supported by the government, was supported by the banks and the credit. And so everybody believed property can only go up. And it was true for the past 30 years. The best thing you could do was save your money, borrow money, buy a property. And so that's what happened. And Xi Jinping gets into power and, you know, he's not the first one to recognize this, but he said, well, we're misallocating credit, right? If we want China to be this manufacturing, you know, country, we want people to have a harmonious society. If we have the most expensive real estate in the world, when you think about it per median income, I had a chart in my essays like Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, like the rental yield is the lowest in the world, meaning the prices are super high. And if you look at the price to median income, apartments in the major tier one Chinese cities are the most expensive in the world. And so obviously that creates a lot of social angst, right? The old own all the shit. And then the young are like, what the fuck? I can't get on the ladder.
I know this movie.
And I'm not going to have any kids. I'm not going to have a family. And so you get sort of birth rate decline, which, you know, in a country that needs young workers to manufacture things, that's also bad. So she says, okay, well, we're misallocating credit. I need to stop it. Now, it's hard to stop it when literally every arm of the government has made money on this. All the major banks have loans against this. All the major industries, the majority of their business is property. And the number one asset held by everybody in China is property. How do you pop that bubble without causing massive social unrest? And so I guess by 2020, after the COVID lockdowns and whatnot, he thought he had enough control politically and economically to pop the bubble. And so they started doing what every country does when they pop a real estate bubble. Same with the Fed did in 2007 and 8. They start raising the price of credit or restricting developers from getting it. And predictably, the market collapsed. And so we're what, 2 or 3 years into this situation, and deflation is sitting hold in China. You know, the median sort of time that it takes to clear a property bubble is, you know, 5 to 10 years. You think about the United States, Japan, it took them, what, 20 to 30 years to get out of it. And so that's what she's staring down the bubble, like, okay, what the fuck? What am I going to do to get out of this situation? And at the same time, you know, the geopolitical situation is heating up. There's proxy wars everywhere between China and the U.S. There's a trade war and all these things, right? And he's trying to right-size the economy in this property bubble. So there's two options. One is you do the Argentinian situation where you do a liquidation of credit. Okay, you bought a property, you lent against this thing, it went down in price. Sorry, that's called capitalism. You lost money. And so you're going to go out of business, you're going to go bankrupt, you're going to fire some workers. That's the one option. That gets rid of all the debt very quick, extremely painful, could cause a revolution, you never know. Or you do monetary chemotherapy, which is quantitative easing, lower the price of credit to zero, make the banks solvent again in fiat money terms, and then do bank-directed credit to get the economy back going, which is what Japan has done, what the European has done, and what the United States has done after their respective property bubbles. And I call it chemotherapy because, yes, while it does cure the economy, the financial sector makes them whole, the banks are whole, they can lend again, you know, destroy the lower middle classes with inflation because you have to financially repress them to make sure the capital doesn't leave. And given the amount of money that China printed to create this property bubble over the last 30 years, they've just, the amount of credit issued in China is enormous. The amount of chemotherapy they're going to have to put on their economy is just going to be next level. And so I know a lot of people think, oh, it's not enough. There's a lot of economists like, oh, China's not doing enough stimulus. Well, everyone said the same thing about the Fed in 2008. What TARP wasn't enough. We need more. By March of 2009, you were doing quantitative easing one. S&P didn't bottom until March 2009. And then over the next, you know, 12 years, massive bull market. And they kept printing trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. The European Union wasn't doing enough in 2011. The euro's going to crack. Mario Draghi gives a speech. Well, do whatever it takes. He's done whatever it takes. They've been printing money since 2011. You know, Abenomics started in the early 2000s. Karuta-san came in and said, I'm going to print the most money ever. You know, yield curve control, quantitative easing. And again, it wasn't enough at the start, but once you do it for 20 fucking years, it's enough. And so it's just wait. Now, they don't have to come out with the full bazooka on day one. It takes a while. And so I think there's a structural bit under sort of, you know, fixed supply assets like Bitcoin and gold that are going to go up because there's just so much Chinese fiat entering the system to reflate their system.
Yeah, what's crazy here is because we've seen this movie play out in the West, like almost like to a T, all right? It's like you were mentioning 2007, 2008. And you actually mentioned earlier in your essay that there's like an underlying reason. I had included into this, but I found this really interesting. There's an underlying reason that governments want citizens to own property. And it's actually, you know, partially, you say, for regime stability. Because when citizens, a larger percentage of citizens own property, they have a shelter, they have a place over their head, and they have something that they need government protection for. Whereas like you think about the basal use case of government is to like secure your property, right? To make sure that somebody with, you know, more guns can't just like come and take your home and your property away from you. So governments sort of want citizens to own property so that they will prop up regimes because they need that security overshadowing it. So this is just a function of governments. And this is why we see, you know, property bubbles basically in any sophisticated, complicated economy. Is that right?
That's my idea on the theory of like why disperse ownership of property in the place of like, you know, organized religion or some other, you know, cohesive rule of why you should respect the authority of the state.
So, Arthur, I do want to kind of compare and contrast the 07 United States housing crisis to the one that you're alluding to in China. The difference that I'm kind of getting is that there's like a little bit more of a like a controlled demolition rather than like an uncontrolled explosion that I think happened in 2007 because we seemingly had no control over it in the United States. It was a complete surprise.
Well, the Fed raised rates starting in 2000 and what? I don't know. Late 2006, early 2007. I mean, you know, the first canary to fall were the two BNP Paribas credit hedge funds. They gated each other. They gated investments in the summer of 2007. Bear Stearns went bust within 7 months. Was bought, and J.P. Morgan had the forced shotgun marriage. The Fed was raising rates. They stopped at that point, but it's always caused by a restriction of credit because the authorities are like, oh, we've gone too far. They recognize they've gone too far, but they think that in their infinite wisdom that what they could prop up, they could also take down very, very slowly and not cause any services. And it's the same hubris in every single central banker or government official. They think that they can build it and they can take it down in a slow and controlled fashion, and it never is the case. And so then they always get to the situation where they have to take the chemotherapy, even though they don't want to take it.
Can you kind of compare and contrast the sizes of these two things? Because like I alluded to, listeners are going to be a little bit more familiar with 2008 and the size of that whole thing versus whatever is going on in China. We're totally uninformed about China. How big is this unraveling, would you say?
The interesting thing about China is that in the Chinese system, as opposed to the US system, most people buy an apartment. So like you get some money and you say, oh, I'm going to move in like 2 or 3 years time. So you buy an apartment off plan. You don't buy used, you buy new.
Oh,
because the bank is going to lend against new. They're not going to lend against used. That's how it works in Asia. So you go get a loan from the bank, put your down payment down for the property developer. And you put down, I think, 10 or 20% immediately. And then within a short period of time, you get your mortgage and then you pay the full balance to the developer before you get the property. You wait years before you get your unit, but you fully paid for it. And so you're trusting that the developer is going to make good on that promise. So the developer is short a house or an apartment, long cash. And so what is any person who runs a scheme like this? They engage in Ponzinomics, where they say, okay, well, I'm going to promise to build more apartments than I have cash to build. But as long as I have a good new sales funnel,
so long as there's growth,
then I can get leverage from the bank on the cash I'm getting in from new marks, and I can build the houses that I promised to build in my prior years. And so that's the game that they ran. And so once the developers lost access to credit, then confidence from the buyers like, oh, fuck, well, is this person actually going to complete this house? And because they didn't have any new sales and no bank credit, they couldn't complete the old apartments. So there's something like, I don't know, however many millions of units promised to be delivered. And the question is, will these developers get enough government financing to do it? So it's a different problem. It's not exactly just straight money. It's they need apartments. So obviously the Chinese government doesn't want to get in the business of building apartments, right? Because if you build it like shit, then they complain to you,
right?
Not the developer that one. Like, so, you know, they've been trying to pussyfoot around the situation of let's give some money here and there. Let's try to incentivize lending. But at the end of the day, it's the market's short millions of units of apartments. Who's going to build them? Right? It's a different flavor of the situation in China based on how the developers are funded.
Okay, so in the United States, we needed to make our banks solvent. So we kind of just injected liquidity straight into the banks. What you're saying is we need to still create like liquidity for these real estate manufacturers. But liquidity is being created either way. It's just like, where is it going is maybe kind of the big difference. But like, I do kind of want to hang on the point of just like trying to measure how big this is. At the end of the day, like if liquidity, it's all about injecting liquidity. Can we measure the size of these two things? Like again, like just how big the United States 2008 housing crisis was versus how potentially large this looming housing crisis is.
I'm trying to think if I can, off the top of my head, I can remember how many trillions of renminbi value of apartments are basically uncompleted. But it's, you know, it's probably in the half a trillion to $1 trillion worth of just like uncompleted apartments that need to be built, right? And so that's the one problem. But obviously, they snowball, right? Because if I'm a customer and my savings is in this apartment, I'm not going to get it. Well, then I'm not buying other stuff.
There's second order effects, right?
I'm not going out shopping. I'm not traveling. My consumer confidence is low. So the money multiplier drops. Mm-hmm. And so I don't go to the bank and borrow money anymore. Right. Not that the bank wants to lend it to me because, fuck, I just lost my apartment. I don't know. I busted my ass to save for this thing. And now the developer's gone bust and I'm not going to get it. So I'm not spending. So it's a multiplier effect on that where you have these millions of people who just, they don't have the units that they were promised to get.
Okay, so massive liquidity injection then by the Chinese government. So like for people though that aren't connecting the dots here, Arthur, in terms of like, why is that good for crypto, right? It's like your base case is, you know, more liquidity equals good for crypto. But somebody might be hearing this and say, but Arthur, isn't like Bitcoin, isn't crypto illegal in China? Isn't it hard to get?
That's wrong, first of all.
Okay, so tell us about that. For someone who thinks that, how does it actually work in China?
So Bitcoin is not banned in China. Certain financial institutions are banned from using it as a payment. The national currency of China is the renminbi. And so certain things you cannot pay with any other currency besides the renminbi. But individuals can own Bitcoin. They can trade Bitcoin. Certain institutions are allowed to hold it as well. What China did in 2007 and then finished up in a few years later is they basically said they went to all the major exchanges, the big three at the time, Huobi, OKCoin, and BTC China, and said, you will no longer have a Bitcoin renminbi trading product because you don't want to see it. We can't ban it. We know that's a fool's errand. People can still hold it, whatever. We know people are going to trade it P2P, but you are not allowed to have a, you know, public display of what this currency is worth in renminbi. And so that is what has been taken down. And so, yes, there's, you know, the large Chinese exchanges all still operate in mainland China. The way they do it is they have these, I don't know if you guys use local Bitcoins back in the day, but it's like that. Sure. It's a messaging board. There's local traders who are able to wire money in and out of bank accounts, and you can buy and sell different cryptos. And that's how you get crypto in China. It is not banned.
So that's how the average retail kind of like mainland China participant would do this with like kind of like a local Bitcoin P2P type of experience.
Correct.
And like how liquid is that market? How efficient is that market? It's obviously not as good as an exchange, but
you can do size, like definitely millions of dollars. I mean, there's definitely a lot of size that goes through that. All the major exchanges, like, you know, the Binances, the OKs, the Huobis of the world, they all have their messaging boards in China and do decent kind of size business. I don't have any sort of numbers on that. It's not really published.
But if you want crypto in China, it's not hard to get, is what
correct.
You're saying.
It's not
bottom
hard.
Line.
It's not like you go to Hong Kong. Obviously, and Hong Kong is China, but not China in the same respect.
Yeah.
But you go to the local currency dealer, it's, you know, Bitcoin, it's a renminbi dollar and USDT, right? USDT is like massive in China, right? People don't understand, like, they think fucking Jeremy Allaire is going to take some business out of Tether. Go fuck yourself. Tether is king in China. They love it. And it's liquid. And that is the flow. And the currency dealers will give you Tether versus renminbi versus US dollar versus
Bitcoin. They trust it more because it's not like Jeremy Allaire and sort of US gov, like, you know, US sanction that's a little gray.
I think it's more of a just, they're very comfortable with the Bitfinex founders.
Yeah.
The Bitfinex founders have been involved in China since the beginning. I mean, they started in Hong Kong, then they were in Taiwan. And so, you know, Tether complies with all the same sanctions regime as Circle. So there's no difference there. I think it's just more, they know the executives, they've trusted the brand, it's been around for a long time. And so that's what's used. And the sort of the flywheel of the, you know, a network effect.
Okay, so if these markets are efficient, if you want crypto and you live in China, you can get crypto. And the Chinese government, you said, like, knows that they can't fully stop kind of like P2P trading, at least not without taking some super draconian type measures that there's like they're not prepared to take. Okay, so that's basically why if your money printing in China, if your money printing, you're the Fed in the US, your money printing in Europe, it all goes back to these store of value, non-sovereign, non-fiat store of value assets like cryptocurrencies, like Bitcoin, right? The same money printing, if it happens in the US or China, it's still flowing back to Bitcoin because this is where people want to hold their values. Is this correct?
Yeah. On the margin, people have a demand for Bitcoin. Obviously, there's bigger demand for gold and maybe foreign assets, right? So there will be capital flight out of China as they create all this currency, and you know, the very rich and connected are able to get their exchange or yuan for dollars and get out of the system. It's all the same sort of flows, and Bitcoin is sort of in that sort of blob of stuff that people are going to buy.
Okay, let's shift towards the US and the Fed, and what's their next move? So, you know, they pivoted somewhat in September. What's happening next?
So if you can afford it, I would highly recommend getting a subscription to Zoltan Pazar's new blog.
Yeah, he's great.
So I saw him at a conference recently, and I went and got a subscription, and I was surfing last week, and you know, in between surfing and yoga and massages, I started reading. I read all his stuff. And so he has some very interesting sort of notes about what quantitative tightening is doing to the markets and how the US Treasury has been fighting it. And so there's been this back and forth battle between Yellen and Powell. Yellen is more powerful than Powell because the US government's debt load is massive and, you know, the US government will get funded. Central bank independence be damned. And so what does that mean? That means that when Powell was doing QT, Yellen did, we're going to drain the reverse repo. We're going to switch the duration or the types of bonds that we issue. Instead of issuing long-dated bonds that nobody wants to buy, we're going to issue these treasury bills, like less than 1 year maturity that everybody wants. And so if you've got, you know, cash in the Fed that earns, let's say, 1%, well, I'll give you 1.05% to buy my debt. So why don't you take your money out of the Fed and come buy my stuff? And so that's what happened. And so, you know, $1 trillion of QT has been done since they started. Well, Yellen did $2.5 trillion of essentially QE. And that's why the markets are ripping. Now, the problem is once the reverse repo facility gets too low, then what happens? She runs out of juice. And so what does she do? She goes over to Powell. She says, stop that QT thing. And he tapered in May when, you know, U.S. Treasury was about 4.5%. I think, and this is, Zoltan gets into a little bit more detail. It's probably not really relevant for this podcast. But his theory is that around this level of overnight reverse repo balances, which is around $200 billion, it actually becomes destabilizing for the money markets that underpin the functioning of the U.S. Treasury market. And so Powell has to stop QT and very soon afterwards start quantitative easing. So my base case is, well, first of all, if Harris wins the election, and I think that the Democrats are incentivized to make sure that financial conditions continue to ease and there's no financial wobbles, which means that I think the Fed on Thursday either stops QT entirely, or they plant some questions in the crowd where Powell can insinuate that QT is going to end in the near future. So you better get ready for it kind of thing and sort of sell that. If Trump wins, I think that they sit back on their hands and they let shit get fucked up because they don't like him.
Really?
Centralized finance held all the power, but now DeFi gives it back to you. Enter the unlimited era with DYDX Unlimited, featuring instant market listings where you can list and trade any market instantly with liquidity. Experience trading like never before with all the trading tools you know and love, all on chain. And then there's Mega Vault, your gateway to automatic liquidity and yield. Just deposit some USDC and start earning yield immediately. It's so simple, and DYDX Unlimited comes packed with so much more. Leverage, prediction market perpetual futures, instant deposits, and there's even a revamped trading rewards program to get rewarded for every time you make a trade. So go ahead and check out DYDX on Twitter at DYDX to get notified once DYDX Unlimited launches. Uniswap Wallet is officially the preferred wallet of Bankless, and it's the one we use anytime when we want to transact on-chain. Whether you're on your browser or on the go, Uniswap Wallet makes it easier than ever to swap anytime, anywhere. Use your wallet to transfer funds directly from a top centralized exchange and tap in thousands of tokens across Ethereum and over 10 other chains like Base, Arbitrum, and Optimism. Uniswap Wallet delivers Deep liquidity, fast execution, and reliable quotes with zero gas swaps through Uniswap X. And when it comes to security, you can rest easy knowing it's backed by Uniswap Labs, one of the most trusted teams in DeFi. Their code is open source and independently reviewed, so you know it's protected. So why wait? Download the Uniswap wallet today on Chrome, iOS, and Android. And don't forget to claim your free uni.eth username directly in the mobile wallet. Start swapping smarter with Uniswap. The Arbitrum portal is your one-stop hub to entering the Ethereum ecosystem. With over 800 apps, Arbitrum offers something for everyone. Dive into the epicenter of DeFi, where advanced trading, lending, and staking platforms are redefining how we interact with money. Explore Arbitrum's rapidly growing gaming hub, from immersed role-playing games, fast-paced fantasy MMOs, to casual luck battle mobile games. Move assets effortlessly between chains and access the ecosystem with ease via Arbitrum's expansive network of bridges and on-ramps. Step into Arbitrum's flourishing NFT and creator space, where artists, collectors, and social converge, and support your favorite streamers all on-chain. Find new and trending apps and learn how to earn rewards across the Arbitrum ecosystem with limited-time campaigns from your favorite projects. Empower your future with Arbitrum. Visit portal.arbitrum.io to find out what's next on your Web3 journey.
So right now, the Fed is like lowering rates, but still engaging in QT. And you think in a Harris world, that kind of reverses and they start moving in the direction of QE.
Well, I think it reverses either way, right? Trump's going to put his own people in power.
Sure, sure.
When he gets there after, if he wins on January, whatever. But in the interim, these people hate him, right? Janet Yellen's been campaigning for Harris.
Yeah.
There's been Fed governors going on the record saying, I'm going to do what's in my power as a Fed governor to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't win. They don't say it like that, but they bet you Donald Trump's name as in bad for American democracy.
Sure.
And therefore, I, as an unelected bureaucrat, am going to thwart the will of the people by fucking some shit up for him, right? So that's, they said this. And so, you know, while I do believe that, you know, from a money markets and plumbing perspective, this has to happen, the timing could get a bit off if the preferred candidate of the government establishment doesn't win.
Yeah, but does this mark kind of a new era that we're in, where sort of fiscal policy and, you know, like Treasury is dominant and Powell matters a lot less than he used to, or the Fed matters a lot less, or do they still like both matter? That, you know, like, which is the tail and which is the dog here?
Well, obviously Yellen has more power than Powell, right? She has, I don't know, was it $40 trillion worth of debt to finance? A lot
more. The more debt you have, the more power you have in the system, basically.
Yeah. So if, you know, think of QE was 2008 to 2000 and whatever, 20, Powell had the power. And then they did stimulus checks, Treasury issued a bunch of money, and then Powell was forced to finance it, right? And inflation went nuts, right? Inflation is still high, right? It's still above his target, and yet he's cutting rates, he's tapering the runoff of his balance sheet, because the Treasury's funding needs are so large that it's causing strains in the well-functioning of the financial markets, and thus Powell has to adjust to match the reality that Yellen is creating. It's not the other way around. And so Powell is just, or whoever will be in charge of the Fed next, is, as I call, the beta cuck bitch tall boy of the Treasury Secretary.
It's like a pretty classic Bitcoiner take that as time goes on, the money printer always just becomes more corrupted. The politicization of the money printer is just inevitable. I think, like, back when we created the dollar on the gold standard, that was the most, like, credibly neutral version, time, era of the dollar that we ever had. And ever, as time has gone on, it's just like there's been just more and more political influences that are creeping closer and closer to the money printer. And now with, like, kind of the, like, formalized flipping of power over the money printer between the Fed and the Treasury, it kind of seems like we're in the final stages of, like, well, eventually we're just going to, like, rip the mask off and just, like, not even pretend that this is political or credibly neutral and just start issuing money in the direction that politics, political parties want it to go. That's the trend that I see. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, but it's cyclical, right? And the Fed and the Treasury were the same organization from 1945 to 1951 in the United States, right? In China, like, the PBOC is just another arm of the state, right? And so they do what she tells them. And so, you know, I think that America will become American capitalism with Chinese characteristics. America needs industrial policy to build the stuff that they outsource to China. And so they're going to have to do the same thing that the Chinese did to build up their manufacturing situation. Financially repress the people at home, allocate credit to the industries that they believe are relevant for fighting a war, right? The chips, you know, the factories, apparently there's going to be some new shipbuilder bill to reshore shipbuilding in the United States, right? All these sorts of things. These are extremely expensive, especially when you have a population that all have liberal arts degrees and no one can, you know, use a screwdriver. So it's just expensive. But it's been done before and it'll be done again. That's a cycle.
All right. Speaking of liberal arts degrees, like maybe that brings us to jobs a little bit. It's like, do you care at all about recession in the U.S.? Does this impact kind of like your models? Are you looking at like jobs reports and this sort of thing?
How do you have a recession when the government is like 30% of GDP? It's almost mathematically impossible, which it is right now.
Is that why we haven't had a recession?
Correct.
Because everyone's been talking about the looming recession. Yeah, the recession's coming. The recession's coming.
Yeah. I have some very expensive subscriptions to people who I respect. I'm like, look, like, you know, in economics, right? GDP, government transfers are a big portion of that. If the government is like 30 to 40% of all economic activity and they're incentivized to increase nominal GDP to tax it, why would they ever let it go down? This doesn't make any sense. And so there will never be a recession.
We're never getting a recession.
No.
Recessions are dead.
As long as the government is willing to run a fiscal deficit, there will not be a recession.
Would there ever be a situation where the government's not willing to run a fiscal deficit?
Well, the voting preferences change, hyperinflation, you know, war aftermath, maybe they've finally deleveraged their balance sheet. There's situations, but we're not in that situation right now. This is this is wartime for US, Russia, China, Europe, right? They're all at war with each other, and so it's time to spend money to build stuff.
Does Europe matter at all in this equation? We talked about China and the U.S. Does Europe matter?
Unfortunately, no. I feel bad for the Europeans, but they just elect some idiots who just keep taking dicks from the U.S. all day.
So there's like limited sovereignty you see in kind of like Europe over its economic destiny.
I mean, look at Germany, right? They foolishly said, I don't want any more cheap Russian gas. And now one of the largest sort of ammonia producers, BASF, is shedding production. All the car manufacturers can't produce cars at the same price level as the Chinese, and they're getting their asses kicked. Economy's slowing, price of energy's down. And so what are they doing? They're importing expensive LNG from the US. And, you know, you can pick a European country and leaders are doing dumb shit because of their allegiance to, you know, America.
Okay, so we got China, money printer. We've got US, money printer.
They're going to print money to, you know.
We're all printing money here.
Everyone's printing money.
Okay, so let's talk about your crypto portfolio right now, or just like in general, how you're positioned for this. Maybe we'll start with like, you know, like cash versus crypto or something like that. So like, how allocated are you into crypto right now?
In my crypto bucket, I'm losing 95% invested. Wow. I have a bit of cash. But yeah, obviously we run a fund. It's all my money anyways, but we have Bitcoin, ETH, and then we have a lot of locked tokens and a lot of projects.
How big is your crypto bucket portfolio percentage versus non-crypto?
Liquid crypto bucket, I don't know, versus non-crypto is probably like 5-6x of the other bucket.
5-6 times larger than the non-crypto bucket? Yeah. Okay, nice.
All right, one of us. You're one of us. All right, cool. Got that established. All right, well, let's talk about Bitcoin and Ether then. So you specifically mentioned Ether. I want to talk about that for a minute because it feels a little bit like Ether, the asset, has been left behind this cycle.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, what's happening to ETH, man? Like, do you have a take on this?
So I still haven't gotten all the numbers together, but essentially, if you take a look at, so let's say post FTX blow up, right? Solana went down to $7 and now it's 170 or 760, something like that, right? Like amazing performance. And ETH went from what, like, I don't know, 1200 to 2500, kind of like double ish, right?
Yeah.
So, like, why has Solana done so well? Well, on a sort of percentage change basis, the profitability, if you own Sol and stake it and become a validator, has dramatically improved over the past sort of 18 to 24 months. And it correlates perfectly with the rise in the price, right? Revenue's up because transactions are higher. You have MEV, you have the sort of the priority fees and all these sort of things, and, you know, and the validator rewards from being a validator, right? So the profitability of the chain has improved dramatically, and therefore the price has done very well. Now, ETH already came into this thing as the top dog, right? In terms of like size of the network. And so on a rate of change basis, obviously, it didn't go down as much either, right? Solana went from 250 to 7. ETH went from, I don't know what, like 3,000 to 1,200?
Yeah.
You know, 50% decline?
4,500, yeah. Something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. And so, but everyone in ETH thinks, oh, it should be up 10,000. Well, show me $10,000 worth of improvement in the underlying metrics of the percentage of circulating supply that has been burnt because there's been transactions on the network. Right. So that hasn't happened, and therefore the price hasn't gone anywhere. But law of large numbers tells me that as Solana gets larger, it's harder and harder to replicate those past returns. And so a lot of the tourists who are in Solana, because it's done so well from 7 to 170 or 160, because things have improved off of a very low base, right? The network had just started almost when FTX blew up. Well, you're not going to replicate that again. So it's going to be hard going forward to replicate the past success. And I think once that narrative shifts and they get a bit of sour grapes, then you start seeing more sort of like activity back on ETH. They're like, oh, well, guess what? ETH, you know, L1 plus some of L2 transaction volume is higher than Solana. The transaction fees are coming down. It's more secure because in a proof of stake situation, it's got a higher total notional value of the network. Therefore, it's more secure. And if we believe that there's like, you know, dangerous state actors or corporations that want to take down competing sort of free association of people using compute, then wouldn't you want the strongest chain, which is the one that has the most value, to be slashed? So I think all these things start to matter when the velocity of change slows down on Solana, because it's past success breeds future failure.
Okay, so that's cool. That's interesting. I do think that's how the market is viewing ETH right now relative to Solana. They're looking at kind of cash flows, and Solana is like throwing off a lot of cash. It's almost looking like a capital asset. I will ask though, this is different than the way people value Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin doesn't have any, I mean, it doesn't have any cash, doesn't have any burn.
It's different.
It's just viewed as like this monetary asset.
Correct.
And so a lot of people that are ETH bag holders, maybe, ETH holders are like, Arthur, dude, different rules apply. Why not? ETH is money, man. ETH could have a monetary premium, this magic thing that just like makes it go up the way Bitcoin like has that. Bitcoin doesn't have to justify itself to like Larry Fink with, you know, the size of its cash flows. So why can't Ether be money? Why can't Ether be like Bitcoin?
Because they decided in 2016 to preserve usability over moneyness when the DAO.
The DAO.
Yeah.
The DAO. That one time.
Well, it takes one
not
time.
Not going to let him off for
it
that.
It only takes one time. Once you do it once, you're fucked. Yeah, it's not money. The community clearly spoke. We want usability. We believe the decentralized computer is better served if we sort of rewrite history and go forward. You cannot be money anymore. You're not money. You are.
Hang on. I want to debate that, because there's been other times post DAO when the Ethereum community did not make that same choice, especially with the Parity hack, and Parity tried to recover. Like,
how large is Parity hack? Percentage based on the total value of the network at the time. Was it the same percentage?
No, it wasn't close to the percentage of the network as the DAO was. But the DAO was like existential. And so I kind of actually think that alludes to my point. Like, because the DAO was existential, like it was kind of like, well, Ethereum kind of fails if the DAO is allowed to proceed.
We don't know that. That's a counterfactual argument. We only know what happened.
Yeah.
So that it was existential. You were presented a choice. Be money, be a computer. We chose, as the Ethereum community, to be a computer. So guess what? You're a fucking computer. And
Bitcoin rolled back the blockchain just like Ethereum did in 2010. Like, there was an inflation bug in Bitcoin, and they rolled back the blockchain.
No one remembers that.
Yeah, no one remembers that. But like, it still happened. I think like some of these things are like lost to history. People are coming into Ethereum these days and don't know about the DAO and don't care about the DAO, and the properties of Ethereum are the same nonetheless.
Well, but the problem is that apart from the history, ETH is useful.
Yeah.
Right? It's spent to do work. When you spend them to do work, you can't be money. Why is oil not money? Because I need to spend it. It's got another...
Oil is money. We got the petrodollar.
Well, the dollar is the worthless currency. The petro is the asset. ETH is an asset. It's not a currency.
You know what's funny about this, Arthur, is we actually had Peter Schiff on the podcast, and he was like, hey, the reason that Bitcoin is not as good at money as gold is because gold has some like utility. You know, like he held up a phone. He was like, how much gold is in this phone? And he was basically like, look, there's some percentage of consumption of gold and it has some utility value, and that actually makes it a better money. I don't know about like the case that just because Bitcoin has no other kind of like use, it's not used as a consumable, transformable kind of commodity, that makes it a better money, because like gold has always been used in industry.
Well, I mean, as a percentage of what gold's use case is, I think gold's use in industry is much lower than ETH. Literally, we're talking about cash flows. You have to spend ETH. The value of ETH as a decentralized computer is predicated on you spending ETH to use a computer. The value of gold as a monetary asset is not predicated on industry using gold.
Let me ask another question, because like we're actually, you know, we could get into like debating this, because we're kind of ETH is money bulls, as you know, Arthur. But like, let me just ask a more general question of like, what would change your mind on this? Because I know you're a trader. I know you're super practical. I know you'd like, you know, you would change your mind on particular assets and the way they're framed if evidence came forward to kind of like persuade you otherwise. What would persuade you otherwise that ETH actually could have some monetary premium?
I think it's so fundamental to what ETH is that unless you're saying that there is no longer any endogenous yield in ETH, the fee is no longer paid in ETH to use the decentralized computer that's hosted on it, I don't think it can ever be money in the way I think about money.
So you think because it has utility.
So if ETH went to $100 million per ETH, that's actually a problem. Because if it's too expensive to use ETH as the commodity that runs the computer, then nobody uses the computer. And so there is a price at which ETH is too expensive, and then it becomes not useful anymore.
Okay.
If the price of oil went to $1 billion per barrel, then the economy collapses and nobody uses oil anymore because it's too expensive.
I got it. I still feel like people get wrapped up around this idea of like they're not separating like Ether is a separate asset from Ethereum block space. Like Ethereum block space is really the oil in this case, right? And Ether is more the petrodollar. It's the monetary unit used to purchase the oil. It's not the oil itself. It's not the actual commodity. So like Ethereum block space could run out. You know, it's a different asset than Ether as the monetary unit.
I don't have a representation of both as a currency. I can't separate them in terms of an asset. So yeah, that absolutely makes sense. But okay, then give me the Ethereum block space money or asset or token, right? That's going to allow me to sort of bifurcate these things and then have the usable thing and the non-usable thing, right?
I guess I have
ETH.
Yeah, I see.
And so it's both.
It's interesting. There have been projects to really like create kind of like a gas token on Ether, a block space token. That might be interesting in the future. But still, you are bullish ETH from a pure cash flow perspective, it sounds like, if you're holding it in your portfolio. So it's on that.
Also, is the most developers. And if we think about the most innovative new things in DeFi or infrastructure, they all start on ETH. They're copied on Solana, maybe it runs faster or whatever, but they start on ETH. And so I still think ETH is sort of the daddy chain. It sponsors all the idea that has some of the smartest people developing new things to take this industry forward. And therefore, I think it's on a long-term basis, a better asset to hold. I love trading Solana. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's liquid. It moves fast. It's got a very good community. Do I want to hold, you know, a large portion of my portfolio in Solana? Fuck no.
Okay, so Arthur, if ETH isn't money, then that implies that some external money needs to be imported into the Ethereum ecosystem because Ether is the only, you know, native asset inside of the Ethereum ecosystem. Everything else is like created downstream of it or is imported from elsewhere. And we have a large amount of like stablecoin imports into the Ethereum economy. We have some amount of Bitcoin imported into the Ethereum economy. So if ETH isn't the money of Ethereum, what do you think will become the money of Ethereum?
No, it's the money of crypto. ETH might be the money of Ethereum, but okay. I'm talking about if I'm thinking of my more portfolio, what's my monetary reserve asset?
Okay.
It's Bitcoin. Yeah, sure, ETH can operate as money within its own ecosystem, but I'm not really trying to like silo myself on.
Oh, we got him. ETH is money, so at least in Ethereum. We got him, David.
If the Ethereum ecosystem grows to become the like dominant backbone of the internet economy, and it like we have all these layer twos, they're in all these different corners of these websites, a bajillion different chains, app specific chains, and they're all kind of hooked into the Ethereum base layer. In that world, if Ethereum does become like the backbone of the internet in terms of like, you know, the internet value, in that world is ETH money?
It could be.
Okay.
Let's see if ETH can do that. And then let's see what actually is happening on chain.
Okay.
So overall, though, this cycle, the bears are saying ETH is dead. This cycle is going to skip ETH entirely. And like we already discussed your concept of the cycle, which is like, why do we need 4 years? Like, we don't need 4 year cycles. It just is what it is. But do you think ETH has a bid at some point in the next couple of years? It's not like dead. We haven't already seen all time highs. Like you're still a believer here.
Yeah, of course I'm a believer. I think ETH is going to do very, very well in this cycle. And again, I think the enthusiasm for Solana will decline as it gets so large that the percentage changes needed to equal the past returns are just not going to happen. It's just hard. Law of large numbers.
What else do you like in crypto? Should we talk meme coins? Should we talk DeFi tokens? I mean, you take us. What are you looking at?
I think my favorite sort of thing that's in our portfolio and probably our largest position, thankfully, is Athena. Mm-hmm. So I think that they are going to do very, very well as yields in fiat are compressed relative to the growth in nominal terms across the world. And if crypto is ripping, the basis that Ethereum is capturing is going to blow out. And so you're going to get back to the 50, 60, 70% annualized yields in Athena, and that's going to bring in the TVL and the token price will go up. Also, I think that the Athena team is doing very, very good work in just systematically knocking down exchange after exchange, use case after use case, and saying, okay, we want USDE as collateral so that people can use it. And we want it to underpin all these different economies. I know that they're working on some of the largest exchanges adding USDE as margin currencies for all of trading, which again is just going to increase that flywheel and get them on the same sort of pedestal as USDT and USDC. And then it becomes a question of like, what types of risks do you want to take? Do you want to take US dollar banking risks? Do you want to take centralized and maybe decentralized exchange custody risk? Choose.
Arthur, I know you're a fan of meme coin speculation. I'm wondering, how do you evaluate a meme coin? What does it take for a meme coin to get onto your portfolio? Are you kind of just like a ape first and investigate later? Or like, do you actually have like a process for evaluating a meme coin?
No, it's like, I got to hear about it, right? So I don't spend much time looking at screens. So I'm doing other shit. And so if I hear about something, obviously I'm late relative to everybody else. Right. Got in early.
Everyone's always late to their meme coin. No one's early to the meme coin.
That's the point. Because I don't have the exact number, but there were some pumped up fund statistics in terms of like the longevity of a meme coin at particular nominal values of market cap and the percentage of the total supply of all coins issued that made it to that level. So to get over like a $500 million market cap is like, there might be less than 50 of these things.
Right. It's like 1 in 100,000 or something.
Yeah. But obviously, if we're talking about meme coins as an attention asset class, you need to be sufficiently large before you get the most amount of inflow into your project.
Right.
So if I'm not sitting at my computer all day, I don't have time to try to find the next, $10 million to $500 million market cap meme coin, then once something crosses 100 million to 200 million market cap, and I somehow hear about it, whether it's on Twitter or somebody mentions it on a podcast or somebody's chatting about it in a chat that I follow, then I'll ape because okay, it's proven that it has enough virality to make it across these very hard hurdles. And therefore, it's more likely to get, Matt Levine and Money Stuff and Bloomberg talking about how dumb it is that these crypto idiots are buying this. Right? When I see that, I want to own that because he's talking about it. He heard about it. So that means all these other Muppets are going to buy it too now.
Right.
Okay, so what's Matt talking about now?
He wrote something about GOAT.
GOAT?
Yeah.
What do you think about this whole like AI meets crypto kind of thing, right? It's like it's starting sort of in the meme coin world, but there are other like crypto projects. Like I think you've written posts about this. I mean, have you pivoted to AI in terms of your portfolio holdings? Are you like NVIDIA's stock and that kind of thing? Or do you think crypto is a good way to get exposure to AI? And what do you think the intersection is here?
Well, I think obviously I've written about this. I think AI agents will use Bitcoin intrinsically because it's something that they can understand from a particular like code basis. Fiat currencies and human legal system is not intrinsic to their world. So that's this one thing.
But they can't have much agency on Bitcoin. They can't do much on Bitcoin.
Why couldn't they do much on Bitcoin? They can, couldn't they spin up their own, data center, build, if you have self-replicating robots, they could build their own ASIC miners. Like, why not?
Oh, that's a future I'm not prepared to think about. I feel like that's pretty far off.
Getting a little physical, a little too physical.
Yeah, obviously it's a longer tail thing, but if I'm an AI, why would I use some fiat currency that lasts 100 years and dies every time a bunch of humans get together and decide to debase it because they want to get reelected? Right? That's the history of all fiat currencies over the last 10,000 years. So knowing that they've literally been trained on everything that we've ever done and written, and they know our history, why would you buy a dollar or a euro or a yen? It will not exist in 100 years. Just, we know this. But Bitcoin theoretically could.
Well, I agree with that. Understanding like human history, like humans always like inflate their own currencies. They always like make their own currencies and they just make it up. And then therefore that like aids itself, lends itself to the value of Bitcoin. But then also you could kind of argue the opposite side of things. Well, like if humans always just end up making currencies, won't the AIs also end up making their own currencies?
Maybe they will. We don't know. Maybe this
is not what GOAT is.
That is like GOAT coin. To me, we're
going to start. It's almost what GOAT is.
They're going to start a shit coiners and they'll move up the stack.
Yeah.
As we all do. Come on. Let's be honest, right? As we all do. But like, I mean, the really neat thing in watching these experiments, like GOAT or also like Luna, this kind of thing is watching them interact on chain. Like a revelation that David and I have had recently, and this has been, we talked about for a while, that the biggest group of unbanked in the world is going to be like basically AI agents. AI agents can't roll up and get a bank account, get AML KYC.
Right.
So they're going to do all of this entirely on chain. And if that's not bullish for selling block space, this block space commodity. I don't know what is having the AI agents as consumers of all of this. You know, are you following that train of thought? Do you think that's bullish for our bags here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's caution that I think that AI agents will be able to fool all AML and KYC forms. So they're all digitized anyways, right? They can fake an image, they can deep fake shit. They'll have bank accounts for sure. But again, I think intrinsically to like commerce that's frictionless, that's cheap enough for them, crypto makes the most sense. Now, whether they create their own cryptocurrency, I don't fucking know. But I think this is an interesting way to start. And that's why I think there's a lot of hype around these AI meme coins, because it's completely new, you know, life force that is entering our space.
Okay, so we talked about the money printer, how that's just like going to happen. We've talked about how you're positioned with respect to crypto. But like over the last, I don't know, 2 years, every so often, at least once a quarter, there's some kind of like war scare that happens, right? I can't even think of the most recent, but obviously we've got, you know, the entire world is kind of a powder keg. We've got Israel and Iran, everything that's going on in the Middle East. You got Russia, Ukraine, you got China and the US, whatever power dynamics are there. And so like, the thing that keeps interrupting this, you know, secular bull feeling is like, suddenly could there be the outbreak of war? How do you position yourself for news events like that? You know, some country is chucking missiles suddenly at another country. Like, you know, war, I think you had this quote, but like war in general is uninvestable, right? You want to be out of these high risk assets, don't you, in those types of conditions. So how do you like trade the ups and downs of this type of thing? Or do you just largely ignore it?
I mean, I think my fundamental thesis is that war is inflationary. And if you look at the price of gold after the oil shock from 1973 to 1980, gold did very, very well. Stocks did very, very poorly, right? So if we believe that Bitcoin and gold are in the same sort of situation where they're stores of energy and energy goes up in war, because what is war is we spend energy to destroy things, which is completely retarded, but it wastes energy. And so the energy that's stored is obviously more valuable. So over time, Bitcoin will keep pace with the price of energy in a wartime scenario. The problem is it's extremely volatile. And so if you are worried about war, then you should be using little to no leverage and you should size your positions accordingly, meaning that like when you go to bed at night, you can keep your phone on silent and do not disturb because you don't care what happens overnight. Bitcoin could be down 75% when I wake up tomorrow. Am I going to sell any? Fuck no, right? Because I understand, okay, well, there's a short-term dislocation. You sell what you can, not what you want. And if Bitcoin is extremely liquid, maybe it's a Saturday night and somebody threw some missiles around, the only thing that people could trade is Bitcoin. They dump that so that their risk is, you know, the right way around on Monday morning when all the other markets reopen. Cool. I'm ready to rock and roll and handle that sort of volatility because I'm not going to get liquidated. But I know that over time, you know, 5-10 years from now or whatever it is, Bitcoin will keep pace with the price of energy, and energy will go up because we're destroying it through war.
So that's how it feels like it should trade, right? It should trade similar to gold. It doesn't always, though.
Yeah, that's what I say, short-term volatility. It's extremely volatile. There's a great chart of gold versus the German mark during the Weimar Republic, and it's like a fucking yo-yo. But obviously, the general trend is a logarithm, you know, an exponential increase in value, and then as the mark was devalued. But if you use leverage, you'd have gone bankrupt multiple times throughout that cycle.
Did you hear about that fund that got bankrupt shorting Luna while it was crashing?
Yes.
Because they took like 100x leverage and they shorted Luna. It would have been a great trade, except they just got bankrupt. They bankrupted themselves like 3 seconds into the trade.
Yeah, Luna's a great thing. The price of Luna was really volatile, mm-hmm. but it was going to zero mathematically. We all knew that once you knew what a death spiral was and the math behind how these algorithmic stablecoins work. But did that mean that it didn't go from like, you know, 10 to 20 in like a few ticks because, oh, then maybe gonna fix it, kind of thing, right? So it's a similar sort of situation. Just don't use a lot of leverage. If you're really worried about war, use, you know, size appropriately, no leverage, and over time you'll be fine.
You said this. I like this line. The worst thing I could do as a trader is trade based on who I think is right on the right side of this war. That will lead you to ruin, as war will be met on either side with financial repression, outright asset confiscation, and destruction. The best thing to do is get yourself and your family out of harm's way and then shepherd your capital into a vehicle that outperforms fiat debasement and maintains its energy purchasing power. That's like a common theme like for you is like fiat debasement and being able to preserve and maintain your energy purchasing power. Is that still how you kind of denominate things? Like at the end of the day for Arthur Hayes, I mean, I remember one time you came on the podcast and you told us like, if you could, you'd like denominate and like, you'd have like, you strap oil barrels to your back and like haul them around as like the way to denominate. Cause that's just like pure energy. Is that still how you're kind of denominating these days and like the cost of energy?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I always divide any sort of fiat asset by the respective central bank balance sheet and see if it outperformed. Tech stocks did well versus the Fed balance sheet from 2008. S&P got smoked. Real estate got smoked, right? So these things are not performing as the currency is debasing. Gold obviously did well. Bitcoin did fucking... Oh, gold didn't do that well. Bitcoin did fucking amazing, right? Obviously from 2008 to the present. And so that's my guiding light of a chart. It's like, here's what happened. I have empirical evidence of what happens when a central bank decides to debase the currency. And we weren't even in wartime, at least in the United States' perspective. And so why would I own general stock indices, right? It's just dumb. I can see in the chart. Doesn't make any sense. I can debase things by the price of oil. And I can see that from 1973 to 1980, a unit of the S&P 500 bought 80% less oil by the end of the decade than it did at the beginning. And so stocks in general are bad inflation hedges. There are particular stocks that do well. You have to be a stock picker, but like the general stock index investing leads to ruin. But gold did well. Gold pretty much was even with the price of oil over after Yom Kippur War and the Iranian Revolution. So obviously nothing is, there's no such thing as a crystal ball, but the historical precedents that I've looked at, you know, assets like gold and Bitcoin will do well as fiat's debased and energy goes up in price in fiat terms.
You still like gold then? You still like gold, Arthur? Or did you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm a vault full of it. I like gold because gold is what the central banks are going to buy. Central banks are buying gold to de-dollarize, to save against war. There's some interesting theories about how Trump or Harris could essentially revalue the gold in the Fed's balance sheet to instantly devalue the dollar, but give the Treasury billions of dollars to spend to do, you know, industrial policy or handouts or what have you, right? Because the Fed's the only central bank in the world where they, I think the carrying cost of gold in the Fed's balance sheet's at $42 an ounce. So if they just put it at the current market price, that's something like $500 or $600 billion of funny money they can hand to the Treasury, which then gets to spend into the economy without increasing the debt load. So there's shit like that. So gold is what the system will buy to reflate itself. The gold price needs to go up 14 times for the general central bank balance sheets to match how much gold relative to the amount of currency was issued that we had in the 1980s. So I love gold.
Okay, you love gold because central bankers love gold, but do you think that changes? Like maybe the current crop of institutional gray-haired central bankers like need to go for that to happen, but like the new generation, does a cryptocurrency, does Bitcoin become kind of the new gold that central bankers like hoard? I'm not talking about like the next 10 years. I'm talking about like, you know, millennials are the new central bankers or something like this. So, you know, 30, 40 years in the future.
I mean, maybe, but I think the trade right now is gold goes up 10 to 20x in the next 5 to 10 years based on just historical precedents and who's in charge right now. Could that change? Sure, of course it could change and my view would change and I'd adjust my portfolio accordingly.
Arthur, since 2022, we've had a major conflict in Russia, in Ukraine. We've had the largest conflict in the Middle East that we've had in a very long time. We haven't had Taiwan in the news for a while, but still nonetheless, like things have kind of escalated over there in that region. Is this a trend that we should pay attention to? Or was the last 2 years kind of just like, are we done with all of that? Where do you think like violence is going on the geopolitical scale?
I mean, I think there'll be conflicts in a lot of other places, right? There's China versus the Philippines. There's, you know, Venezuela versus Guyana with their oil fields. There's what's going on in the, you know, former French colonies in northern and western Africa. And all these are just flashpoints between the United States and NATO and then Russia, China, Iran, mm-hmm. right? And so there are all these different flashpoints. And the theory goes is the reason why, you know, nuclear powers like Russia, China, and the U.S. fight proxy wars is because no one wants to engage directly with each other because they're afraid of thermonuclear retaliation and war, right?
Right.
Let's hope that theory holds. Because you know, of course, it's very sad that all these people are dying in all these different places. But if we exterminate the entire human race because a bunch of old fuckers decide to throw missiles at each other, that'd be even worse.
Yeah, that would be very bad for the price of crypto.
We wouldn't be around. It wouldn't matter.
It wouldn't matter anymore.
Yeah, it's uninvestable. Yeah,
it totally is. Thermonuclear war is completely uninvestable. All right, let's end with this then, Arthur. Over the years, you've given a lot of advice, like good advice, I think, like to crypto investors and traders. What's your best advice for them at this, you know, point in the cycle? Like, what should they be thinking of? What should they be doing?
Read a book about World War II.
World War II.
And what happened, World War II, World War I, what was life like for, you know, the average man, woman, and child during these wartime periods? And, you know, see how shitty it was. And then the next time some dumbass politician is trying to get you to wave a flag and go send your son or daughter off to war, I say, fuck you to them, because this is fucking retarded. And so I think that would solve a lot of problems. People don't read any books. They don't understand history. No one was around then. So they think that, you know, this is a glorious thing to go and throw missiles at each other around the world. I'd say that's an advice. And you'll also see what happened in the finance, because all the things that we're about to do in every major country have been done before in wartime. And so the playbook is there. Of course, there wasn't Bitcoin back in the day. There was gold and other ways of sort of trying to protect your wealth. But similar sort of principles applied, and similar sort of ways when people made a lot of money and people lost fortunes as well.
Yeah, big plus one on that and reading history. I mean, it kind of sucks for us too. It's like the old generation that was around, like the World War II vets and people who lived through kind of like the 1920s, 1930s. It's just like they're disappearing. So you can't have a conversation with your ancestors. So like a way to do that is to go read a book. Arthur Hayes. Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks, you guys.
Great to have you back on. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers.
Got to let you know, Bankless Nation, of course, none of this has been financial advice. Crypto is risky. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.